way of warning them. One last chance to save yourself. Realize something is badly wrong and do something about it. Tell someone. Don't walk home alone like you may have planned. Call an authority. They never did. He'd yet to work out whether this was because they didn't get the significance of seeing their possessions somewhere it shouldn't be, or because they were too embarrassed to do anything of the things he hoped they would. So he'd been in Amy's apartment at St. John's. He'd chosen his item. A rainbow-coloured dream catcher that Amy had hung off the end of her curtain rail. Half the time, he bet, it was obscured by the curtain itself, but that was perfect. It was the kind of thing she might not miss for a few days, but would instantly recognise as her own when she saw it somewhere else. Somewhere wrong. He was just reaching for it when he heard the lock turn in the apartment's main door. Amy was supposed to be at work, going straight out afterwards. Her roommate was supposed to be out already. He spent a terrified, panicked second standing in the middle of Amy's bedroom, paralysed with indecision. What should he do? Make a run for it. He couldn't. She'd see him. Get in the wardrobe. Too small. And what would he do if she pulled open the door? Get under the bed. It was his only option. Maybe she was just picking something up that she'd forgotten and would leave again soon. She was supposed to go straight out after work. He'd even seen her take a tote bag with a change of clothes in it. The club had a drinks promotion on that night in an attempt to lure students out on a Sunday, the dregs of the weekend, when all their money was already spent and their livers were struggling to cope. The club had set up a Facebook event advertising it, and Amy had registered as attending. He was going to tail her for the evening and hope he'd get the chance to walk her home. Amy never walked home alone, but that didn't mean she didn't make other bad decisions. She demonstrated that time and time again. Her life was all over the internet, and he'd followed her nearly 10 times now without her ever noticing. And in broad daylight. Clearly, she still needed his help, and he needed hers. She would make a good example, serve her time as a cautionary tale. Like Louise had. Like Jennifer was currently doing. Reminders that not everyone was as nice a guy as him. Amy may not walk home alone, but she'd chat to the nice man who'd bought her a drink at the bar just at last call, tolerate his company when they both turned out to be walking home in the same direction, fail to notice as their pace slowed, as he manoeuvred himself around her until he was on her right side, the dark waters of the canal on her left, watching for a gap in foot traffic. A break from passing cars. He was counting on it. But then, instead of going out, she'd clattered around the kitchen for a bit, showered, and inexplicably got into bed. For a while he'd simply laid there, silently seething. His whole night, all his careful plans had been ruined. But then, slowly, he'd realized something. Amy was doing what he wanted more than anything. In abruptly changing her routine, she was protecting herself. A slow pride smile had spread across his face. But then she'd woken up and saw him as he was trying to leave. Saw his face. He couldn't have that. He did it there in the room. Grabbing her by the shoulders as she jumped up from the bed and ramming her as hard as he could, face first, into her wardrobe door, right where the sharp ridge of the steel handle was sticking out. He heard a sickening crack. Blood spurted from what was left of her nose. She went limp, the echo of her aborted scream hanging in the air. There was blood everywhere. That's when he realized he hadn't thought it through. Blood on the wardrobe door, brush strokes in it from her hair as she'd slid down, blood dripping from her nose and, he saw now, the wound in her head as well. The skin on her scalp had split dramatically, and one ragged edge of it was hanging loose, flapping open like wallpaper that had come unstuck. The blood was dropping onto the carpet, onto his clothes, onto her clothes. As he picked her up under the arms, he felt more blood falling onto his arms, spilling down over them, collecting in sticky pools in the cuffs of his shirt. Swallowing down panic, he forced himself to think methodically. He pulled a blanket from her bed, rolled her up in it, and carried her into the bathroom, setting her down in the shower tray. She slumped, lifeless, against the tile wall, but holding a finger directly under the mess of fragmented bone and blood that had been her nose, he detected a faint breath. He took off his shoes and placed them in the shower tray with her. Then he found a packet of antibacterial wipes on the floor under the toilet and retraced his steps with them, down the hall as far as the bedroom door, checking for drops of blood. He found none. The blanket had caught them all. On into the kitchen. There was a small bin by the fridge filled with pizza crusts, empty cans and used tea bags, and a plastic carrier bag. Back down the hall into the bathroom. He checked his watch. Still plenty of time, so long as the roommate didn't change her plans too. He put a hand on the back of Amy's head, trying not to transfer more blood, and gently pulled her towards him. Then he fit the plastic bag over her head, pulled it down as far as it would go, and tightly knotted the handles of it under her chin. Slid the shower door closed. Went back into the bedroom. Started the cleanup. He wasn't worried about making the blood go away. He knew it was impossible now, really, to do that. He just didn't want anyone to notice what had happened in there for a while. Give himself a day, maybe two. So he wiped down the wardrobe door, blotted the carpet stain, moved some of the clothing debris pile over it, carefully arranging it so it appeared to be just as haphazard as the rest. All the used wipes went into a bin liner he'd pulled from the wastebasket in the bathroom. While he worked, he heard a faint knocking noise coming through the wall. Movement in the shower, it sounded like. He ignored it. A few minutes later, it stopped. In the moments after he smashed Amy's skull into the wardrobe, he had no clue how he was going to extract her body from the apartment. From the apartment block, one of several, right in the middle of a well-lit college campus. But he trusted himself to think of something in due course, and by the time he had finished cleaning up, an idea had come to him. It was the bin in the kitchen that made him think of it. There were wheelie bins, kept in a small enclosure outside round the back. If he could get one of them up here without being challenged, he could get Amy out in it again. He'd use the fire exit at lobby level to avoid meeting other students coming and going through the front doors. He knew the warning sign above the fire exit being alarmed was just for show. So that's what he did. Found an almost empty bin, brought it upstairs in the elevator, stuffed Amy into it. Wheeled her out again. Lifted the bin into the back seat of his car lying it lengthways. He was worried about the weight of it, but he found that by lining it up with the door and then tipping the end of it up, he was able to slide it in without too much effort. Then he drove to the 3-bed semi in Ranelagh, let himself in the side gate, and wheeled Amy into the shed. It was nearing midnight by then. He didn't have time to go home and shower, so he fetched his uniform from the boot of his car and changed into it before heading back to St. John's to start his shift. Kevin was on, reading a lad's magazine in the security booth. Lazy, incompetent Kevin, who would be easy to blame if anyone came looking for footage later and found it wasn't there. "Hey," he said to him, "time to clock off." Kevin stood up, stretched. "Not a moment too soon, let me tell you, not a moment too soon." "Anything strange or startling?" "Nah." Kevin yawned. "Sunday night, isn't it? Yawn again tomorrow." "I'm only part-time, not back again until Friday."
"Lucky you."
He collected his things.
"Well, have a good night."
"Thanks," he said. "You too." He waited until he saw Kevin's car drive past the camera mounted at the staff car park's gates before he went into the security camera system and started searching for tonight's recordings, deleting where necessary as he went. There'd been plenty of times over the last few months when he'd regretted taking this job. 3 days a week he had to stay here, awake, all night, and then go into R&P and pretend to be awake for 8 hours more. But that night, he was glad of it. That still left Amy's body, the one lying at his feet now in the shed. This was his listing. No one else from the agency would have reason to visit. The owner, however, might. He wasn't sure how close by they lived, but if they happened to visit, they might see the shiny new padlock on the shed's door and wonder why it was there. They might look inside. He's inside now, poking around the shelves, lifting lids off boxes, picking through the tools hanging off nails on the back wall. Looking for something. Something sharp.
Allison, now. When I opened my eyes the next morning, the first thing I saw was another pair. Large white ovals with little black dots floating in the middle, glowing in the near darkness, staring at me. What the? Cartoon eyes. They were cartoon eyes, painted on a round little ball of blue that, now that my eyes were adjusting, I could see was supposed to be an owl. A plastic owl, with a little slot cut into his head. A pair of sunglasses were resting in the slot. Their lenses at an angle over the eyes. It was a glasses holder, shaped like an owl. Malone's owl-shaped glasses holder, to be specific. Sitting on his bedside table. And me, asleep in his bed. Well, not quite asleep. I'd spent most of the night lying awake, staring at the ceiling and thinking of all that had transpired yesterday. Discovering the photo of CCTV man among the photos from St. John's. Telling Will I'd corrected my statement about the night Liz had died. Watching the videotape of his confession. And of course, finding a copy of the letter a killer sent, potentially left in my hotel room by another one. Or maybe the same one. It was getting hard to keep everything straight. I didn't know what to think anymore. The only thing I was sure of was that I'd welcomed a holiday from thinking altogether. When my phone beeped with the alarm I'd set for 7, I quickly silenced it and strained to listen for any other sounds. There was only silence. Malone must still be asleep on the couch. Thanks to a lack of sleep, every limb felt weighed down, my head foggy, my stomach hollow and unsettled. After discovering the letter last night, I'd sat mostly in stunned silence while Malone tried to take my mind off things with some humorless comedy film and what was cold, greasy pizza by the time we got around to opening the box. He'd never seen the letter before.
I'd heard about it,
he'd told me, but there's no copy of it in Garda files. The original was lost, I thought. Then where did this come from?
I'd say the source is someone who worked on the paper back then. They could have made copies. They more than likely did. But as to who put this in your suitcase and how they got it, that I don't know. I can have it checked for prints, but prints are no use unless you have a set to check them against, so...
Why give this letter to me? Malone had shrugged his shoulders.
Your guess is as good as mine. Because you've been seeing Will? Because you'll tell him about it?
He's the one who first mentioned it to me. Malone raised an eyebrow.
How did he know about it?
He said some other patient told him. He'd read about it online. I'd pretended to watch the film then and mechanically chewed a few bites of pizza without actually tasting it. By the time the credits rolled, my eyelids were heavy with a longing for sleep and the thought of going back outside into the dark and the cold and driving all the way to Bray only made me feel even more exhausted. I didn't argue when Malone suggested I stay in his place for the night, or give my mother a chance to argue with me when I told her that's what I was doing. I sent her a text saying I was staying somewhere in town, that it was too late to drive out to Bray, and that I'd call her in the morning. But then, having crawled gratefully into the warm softness of Malone's bed 5 minutes later, sleep suddenly proved elusive.
After I dressed, I sat on the bed and listened again for signs of life. I didn't want to wake Malone, which I'd probably do the second I opened the bedroom door. The couch was right outside it. I'd let him get up first, even though I so desperately wanted a cup of coffee I could almost smell it, like some kind of olfactory mirage in the middle of a decaffeinated desert. Except, was I actually smelling it? I heard it then, the tiniest little tinkle of steel against ceramic, a teaspoon in a cup. While I'd been sitting here waiting to hear Malone up and about so I wouldn't disturb him, he'd been up and about as quietly as he could be, so as not to disturb me. I found him in the kitchen setting two large mugs of steaming coffee on the breakfast bar. The kitchen's only border with the living room. A half-empty cafetiere was sitting on the countertop, an inch of coffee left in it, sodden black grounds packed tight at its base. Morning. He pushed one of the mugs toward me. I was just about to knock on the door. Did you sleep? No, I said. Not really. But you were so tired. Yeah, well, my brain didn't care. As I mixed sugar and milk into my cup, I noticed that Malone was wearing a dark shirt that seemed to be specked with raindrops. Were you outside already? He lifted a brown paper bag off the countertop, foraging for croissants. You didn't have to do that. I hoped my stomach wouldn't rumble a contradiction. After only a couple of bites of that pizza yesterday evening, I was starving. No, I really did, Malone said. Otherwise your breakfast options would have been a jar of slicked gherkins, or a tube of tomato puree, or a combination of those two things. As for that, he pointed at the cafetiere, I had to YouTube how to use it. Normally I just chuck a spoon of Nescafe in the general direction of boiling water and hope for the best. Well, I appreciate it. The coffee especially. Come on then, Malone said. Bring your cup. He crossed the living room to the sliding doors that led out onto the balcony, nudging them open with an elbow. I followed. The balcony was small, only big enough for a cafe-style set of chrome table and two chairs, and the room to walk sideways, crab-like, around them. Directly above it hung the underside of the balcony of the apartment on the floor above, but this also meant it was sheltered from the weather. The table and chairs were dry, even though the railing was splattered with raindrops. We set our cups on the table and sat down. I looked through the gaps in the railings at the overgrown green, glistening with dew, then lifted my eyes to take in the fenced-off row of half-finished houses, then... Oh, wow! Beyond the houses, in the far distance, was a mountain range. Green hills rolled unevenly across the horizon, rounded peaks, wide valleys. In places, stark, bare rock poked through. Off-white clouds, heavy with rain, hung low in the sky above them, casting enormous shadows that moved as I watched. Nice, isn't it? Malone said. I bring my Nescafe water out here every morning. If you sit just right, you have a great view. Yeah, I said. It's wonderful. There was no noise at all. No other people. No traffic. Not even birdsong. The air was fresh and cool, and although the weather was grey and wet, there was something fantastically impressive about the view from Malone's balcony. It was a reminder that even with all that was going on, even the mess that lay around us, life was bigger than this mess. I was. The view soothed me. I sank down into my chair, letting my muscles relax, breathed in the smell of my coffee, took a sip and savored the buzzy caffeine hit. Told myself it was a normal morning. Just a normal Tuesday morning. Nothing out of the ordinary. Nothing to see here. The doorbell rang. It wasn't even 8. Malone was already getting up out of his seat. He didn't seem at all surprised that someone had called around this early in the morning. He'd been expecting this, I realized. We should go in, he said. Who is it? All I got in answer was the rattle of keys against the front door. By the time I'd picked up my coffee, stepped back inside, and slid the balcony door closed behind me, Garda Emily Cusack was standing in the living room, and she was glaring coldly at me. Here it is, Malone said, handing her the plastic wallet he put the letter in. I talked to Shaw last night, so he's expecting it. Alison handled it, so we might need her to come in and provide prints.
He looked at me. That's fine, I said.
You found this in your suitcase?
Cusack asked me. I nodded. Yeah.
Malone asked Cusack if she remembered whether or not the outside pocket had been open when she'd picked it up from the hotel. All I did was throw the stuff in and zip up the main compartment. She held up the plastic wallet. And this could be nothing. It could just be from some crank. That's what they thought at the time. It might not even be that letter. Somebody could have made this on their computer. Then she turned and looked at me. Accusingly, I thought. Want some coffee? Malone said to Cusack. I got the distinct impression he was trying to distract her.
I made the proper stuff.
I highly doubt that, Cusack muttered. But she went into the kitchen, opened a cupboard, and took down a mug. Did you hear about the CCTV appeal? Malone glanced at me. I have to call work, I said. I'll do it from the bedroom. I dialed Suncamp's number and left a message confirming I wouldn't be in today either, and that tomorrow was looking bad. After I hung up, I listened. Low mumblings were coming through the wall. Malone and Cusack clearly needed a few minutes to discuss in private whatever had happened with the CCTV appeal, so I took the opportunity to call Sal. Voicemail. I checked the time. Breda was an hour ahead. She'd already be at work. I left a message saying I was fine, and I'd try to call her later. I waited in the bedroom for another 3 minutes, perched on the edge of the bed, looking out the window. Then I went back outside. Just as I opened the bedroom door, I heard Malone say, "Watch the confession." Cusack was rolling her eyes. "You and your conspiracy theories. You'll need a tinfoil hat soon." Malone saw me.
"Everything all right?"
I nodded. "Yeah, all good." All three of us stood there in awkward silence then. "Right," Cusack said. "I'm off." She took one last swig of her coffee and set the cup down on the countertop. To Malone. "Can we, talk for a second?" She jerked her chin towards the hall. The two of them left the room, him following her. A moment later, furious whispers started in the hall. This time, I didn't think they were talking about the case. I was guessing Cusack was the one with all of Malone's decorative accessories. She had keys to his apartment and knew her way around his kitchen. Still, I couldn't see it. Couldn't imagine them as a couple. Although, wasn't the point that they weren't together anymore? That was easier to see. My eyes fell on the cardboard box Malone had brought in from the car last night. Someone had scribbled in marker on its side, SJ Accommodation Apps, 2006/7. Application forms for on-campus accommodation at St. John's, I was guessing. A single A4 sheet that we had to submit by post. Thanks to the idiocies of the Irish college application system, you only found out if and when you'd got a place a few weeks before term began, making late summer a mad, desperate dash for student digs in every college town in Ireland. St. John's guaranteed a room on campus for all incoming freshmen, but only for those who'd won their places in the first round. Liz, for instance, had only got in on the second one, and so had to go on the waitlist. I'd managed to accidentally end up on the waitlist after failing to properly confirm acceptance of my first round place. Hadn't Malone said something about getting me to look at a list of residents to see if I recognized CCTV man's name? We'd never got around to it, overtaken by confession videos and letter discoveries. I looked towards the hall. The whispering was still going strong. I hoisted the box up onto the coffee table and lifted off the lid. There were three ring binders inside, application forms for the academic year 2006/2007, arranged alphabetically by surname. I sat down on the couch and transferred the first one into my lap. The first page in it was completed in barely legible handwriting, dated August 2006. The binder was several inches thick with more. I took another sip of my coffee and started working my way through. All the forms were well thumbed, some folded down at corners, many curled and yellowing. A handful were in plastic wallets because their punched holes had ripped through to the edge and would no longer stay on the binder's rings. Some had handwritten notes scribbled on them. Others had been branded with a date stamp. In the bottom right-hand corner of each was a large blank box marked allocation, and these had been filled with a code that corresponded to the single rooms and halls. A4, B18, C20. Each letter was a floor, each number a room on it. Each form was signed and dated by a member of St. John's staff. I scanned only the student's name on each form. I recognized some of my former classmates, but none seemed possible candidates for the man in the photo. The majority of forms were on white paper, but some had been printed on blue. I was halfway through before I realized why that was. All the blue ones had a box marked W ticked at the top and a submission date in September. W stood for waitlist. Waitlist. The word snagged on something in my subconscious. It started rising, tugging an idea to the surface. Quickly, I flipped through the inch-thick sheaf of paper in each binder and pulled out all the blue pages, all the waitlist forms. I ended up with a stack of 30 or so. Every form had a room allocation written on it, so these were clearly only the forms of people on the waitlist who had subsequently secured a room. I licked a finger and thumbed through the blue stack. Lauren Murphy, check. Carolyn Brady, check. Rachel Folan, check. Elizabeth Whelan, check. Kira O'Shea, check. They were all there. All five victims from before. All five of them had been on the St. John's Hall's wait list. And someone else was in there too. Heather Buckley, also an incoming freshman in the autumn of 2006, also on the wait list for accommodation in halls. That had to be the same Heather Buckley who Shaw had said was a victim of a thwarted attack, the one saved by a Good Samaritan who then inexplicably ran off. When Malone came back into the room a couple of minutes later, I was tapping keys on his laptop. Sorry, I said, but I think I found something. I turned the machine's screen toward him. Heather hadn't changed her name, and better yet, she hadn't left Dublin. She hadn't even left St. John's. According to the university website, she was working there as a research assistant, based in the college library. Who's that? Malone asked, squinting at the screen. Someone who can help us, I think. Help us do what? Find the canal killer. I looked up at him. Can you drive me to St. John's? Allison, now. We never really had to consider that, Malone said as we crawled through the South Dublin suburbs in heavy morning traffic. How he was choosing them, I mean. Will did it. He was a student. He lived in halls. So did all the victims. That was the connection. Case closed. But if it wasn't him, I said, then how he chooses them becomes important, right? To say the least. And if we figured it out, it could help find the guy now. Possibly, yes. The car inched forward. The letter said the focus should be on the victims, I said, not the killer. If that's real, it sounds like he's saying there's a connection between them other than him, right? I felt Malone's eyes on me, and I turned to him. What? Are you saying? He looked at me questioningly. I just want to know the truth, I said. I'm not saying anything yet. We were stopped at red lights that had just turned green, and Malone hit the horn to alert the driver in front of us to this fact. What does them all being on the waitlist tell us? He asked. Maybe nothing, I said. But I can't believe that. You saw how many accommodation forms there are. Halls must be able to take hundreds, if not thousands, of students, but only 30 or so of the freshmen in that binder, the freshmen who ended up living in halls, came from the waitlist. And all five victims, plus Heather Buckley, who Shaw thinks might have been the canal killer's practice run, or failed first attempt or whatever, were on it too. It has to be the connection. They must have all done something, or met someone, or been somewhere that only people who are on the waitlist do, or meet, or go. Before we'd left his apartment,
Malone had printed out the best shot of CCTV man from the images the Gardaí had collected, and a copy of the photo I'd found of him in my old album, from a scan of it Malone had stored on his phone. They were sitting in my lap.
"I think this is a bad idea," he said as he took a right turn onto a street that ran parallel to the canal. "You walking around that campus?"
"That's where Heather is.
Maybe I should come in with you."
"No, that makes it too serious, too scary. I just want her and me to be able to have a chat." The canal was a hive of activity. I counted several uniformed Gardaí, two satellite trucks and dozens of nosy onlookers collected by the Gardascene Do Not Cross tape that had been strung between the trunks of the trees on the canal bank.
"Did they find something?" I asked.
"No," Malone said. "Not yet." He parked across from the main entrance to the campus on Haddington Road.
"You sure about this?" he said, turning to me.
"I won't be long. I don't plan on hanging around."
"I'm going to follow you, but I'll keep a distance behind. Where's her office?"
"In the basement of the library."
"Okay, well, when you go in there, I'll wait outside. Afterward, we meet back here. If you see any press or anyone starts bothering you, call my phone. Okay?"
"Okay." I got out of the car and crossed the street. The first thing I saw was the lettering above the entrance, St. John's College, Dublin. A different font to what I remembered. They must have rebranded since. Everything else looked exactly the same. I bit back the urge to turn around and run. It's just a place. Buildings made of brick and glass, surrounded by strangers. Nothing bad had happened here, if you discounted my meeting Will, which actually technically hadn't happened here. We'd met in a bar in town. It wasn't a bad place. It just held bad memories. Or good memories gone bad since. St. John's campus had always seemed to me to be a metaphor of sorts for what being a St. John's student was like. The entrance on Haddington Road was a narrow archway between two imposing limestone buildings, the classical architecture reminding you that St. John's had been around for a couple of hundred years and your brief enrollment there would be but a blink in its history, so don't go getting any notions. The campus had been built on the site of an old army barracks, but Haddington Hall, as it was known, was the only original building the college had kept. It was what everyone thought of when they thought of St. John's. History, tradition, money. It even formed the logo. But walk through the arch, and you'd soon see what St. John's looked like to its mildly disappointed student body. A sprawl of 80s-era structures, haphazard and mismatched, almost every one of them an eyesore. The science block with its innards on the outside, aiming for the Pompidou Centre, but landing much closer to a sewage treatment plant. Postgraduate accommodation clad with white panels that had looked sleek and clean for about 5 minutes, and then only dirty and streaked with deep brown rust stains after that. A library built to look like a giant concrete block, with long, narrow windows buried deep in folds of grey brick. One summer it had been used as a filming location for some bleak, dystopian Hollywood movie. It had served as a prison in it. People sent their children here because they figured it had been around for so long, it must be something special. But students soon discovered that the sheen of reputation, much like the cobblestones, didn't extend much beyond the archway. Inside, it was just like any other college. It was still early Tuesday morning. The campus was busy, but not thronged with people yet. I headed straight for the library, walking fast, eyes down. I had no plan, really, other than to find Heather's office, knock on her door, and tell her who I was. I hadn't anticipated the turnstiles, or what to do to get around them. When I'd been a student here, we just walked straight in. I pushed against the horizontal steel rod at my hips, but it didn't budge. A small black device with a glowing red light was mounted on the side, sliced through the middle. You needed a key card to get in. Your student ID, probably. While I stood there trying to decide what to do, a young girl with headphones on approached the next turnstile over. I watched as she whipped her ID card through the device. The light turned green, and there was a little electronic beep. When she pushed against the steel rod, it gave. After shooting me a look, she sauntered on through. Are you all right there? I turned. There was a counter off to the left, and a woman wearing a campus security t-shirt was standing behind it, looking at me questioningly. She narrowed her eyes now and said, Library's just for students. I didn't want to say that I was here to see someone, because that would no doubt necessitate providing a name, and Heather being warned in advance of my arrival. So I said, I forgot my ID. That probably sounded a bit weird considering I was making no effort to search for it in any pocket or in my bag, so I added, I just realized. She raised an eyebrow. What course? English, first year. The other brow shot up.
You're a freshman?
I smiled. Yes, a mature one. We stood there for a second longer than was comfortable, with her staring at me and me smiling inanely at her. God, what did she think I was going to do in there? Steal a load of literary theory texts because I found them just so damn riveting? Another student approached the desk then, putting security lady under pressure. She threw me one last suspicious look before pressing some unseen button, turning the light on my turnstile green.
You won't be able to borrow anything, she warned.
I'm just checking something. I pushed through. Thanks. I walked past a long counter manned by library staff, through a seating area, around some sort of gallery exhibition showing photos of the campus throughout the years, and onto the elevators. I didn't see any stairs, so I got in the first available car and pressed B for basement. When the doors opened a floor below, I found myself in a labyrinth of grey carpeted corridors, each one the same as the one before. Little signs hung beside every office door, but the numbers seemed, at best, to be following some sort of hidden code rather than any logical sequence.
Can I help you?
A short, grey-haired man was suddenly standing in front of me, clutching a sheaf of papers with one hand and pushing his thick-framed glasses back up his nose with the other. He managed, somehow, to look both suspicious and friendly at the same time.
Yes, I said. Well, maybe. I'm a bit lost. I'm looking for Heather Buckley's office.
The man looked me up and down.
Are you here for the interviews?
He turned and pointed down the hall.
Go right then left. You'll see a waiting area. Have a seat there and she'll come out and get you.
He winked at me.
Best of luck now. Don't be nervous. Heather's lovely.
I thanked him and started down the hall. I soon found the seating area, but no one was waiting there. I sat down. Moments later, the door to the nearest office swung open, throwing golden light out into the dim hall. A young girl of maybe 20 came out first, smiling and laughing, turning to say something to the older woman who was following behind. Heather. It had to be. Her unnaturally white blonde hair was chopped up short into a style that aimed for ease rather than flattery, although it flattered her all the same, and she was tall and thin, but not gaunt-looking. She was dressed head to toe in black, black boots, black tights, black skirt, black shirt. She wore no makeup that I could see, but still managed to look luminous, somehow. Maybe because she didn't wear any. Thanks so much for coming in, she was saying to the young girl. And sorry again for making you wait. It's been a bit of a morning around here. We'll hopefully be in touch in the next couple of... Her eyes landed on me. She frowned, then took a step closer.
Allison.
Hi, I said, surprised that she'd recognized me. But then I remembered that my face had been on front pages yesterday, and someone who'd potentially had a brush with the canal killer might be interested in keeping up with the facts of the case.
I was, hoping we could talk, if you have a minute.
When a look of horror crossed Heather's face, I added, I'll be really quick. The younger girl was looking from one of us to the other, and then back again, unsure of whether she should stay or go.
Thank you,
Heather said to her pointedly, and the girl turned and went, then to me.
I'm going to bloody kill him.
Sorry?
The Gordie have only just left. Please don't tell me he's been bothering you too.
I was completely lost.
Sorry, who?
Daniel. Heather said with an eye roll. He's why you're here, isn't he? What else has he bloody gone and done?
Alison, now. Heather's office was small, the width of the window that ran floor to ceiling at its far end. One wall was taken up with rickety bookshelves, thin MDF slats affixed to unsightly brackets, each one bending and bowing under the weight of books, papers, and stacks of magazines. A desk was pushed up against the other one, with only a computer, a bottle of water, and a neat stack of manila folders sitting on it. Heather slid in behind the desk, motioning for me to take the hard plastic office chair on the other side. I noticed a thin silver band on her wedding finger, but there were no personal photographs anywhere in the room. I wondered who she was married to, if it was someone she'd met in St. John's. I wonder if maybe I knew him.
You don't remember me, do you?
She said, once we'd both sat down.
You were in a few of my classes.
Oh.
I didn't.
No, sorry.
Did you really not know?
It's all so long ago, I said, and I try not to remember. I meant about him.
I
felt my cheeks colouring.
Sorry, Heather said. That was rude of me. Forget I asked.
She folded her arms.
Should you really be here? I saw the newspapers. Yesterday and today. Isn't this like ground zero? Aren't you making it easy for them to find you? And if they do, they'll get a shot of you on campus. I don't think that's good for you or the university. Do you?
I didn't know if it was my lack of sleep or Heather herself, but I was finding it hard to navigate this conversation. And who was Daniel? I came to ask you for your help. I took my phone out and brought the nightclub picture up on screen. I passed it to her. Do you know who?
Yeah, she said, that's him. And it's him in those CCTV pictures too. I told the guards all this already.
You told? I'm sorry, I'm not quite following.
That's Daniel, Heather said.
Daniel O'Dowd.
No, I don't know where he is if he's not at home.
She looked at the picture again.
Where did you get this? Is that you?
It's mine. I had it in an album. So was Daniel at St. John's too, or? There was a blur of movement in my peripheral vision. I turned to my left and saw that someone had arrived at the seats outside the office and was looking around. Another young girl. She hesitated for a moment, then sat down. Heather's next interviewee, probably. When I turned back, Heather had begun tapping something out on her keyboard. I thought for a second she was trying to get rid of me until she twisted the monitor around to show me what was on screen. A website. The header photo was a moody black and white shot of water, with a hand-sketched map of what looked to be Dublin layered over it. Superimposed on that, cartoonish red lettering dripping with droplets of blood, beneath the surface.
That's Daniel, Heather said. That's his, she rolled her eyes again, blog.
I could only see the title of the most recent blog post. Breaking news, Garda water unit searching for SJC student in the Grand Canal. He must have posted that this morning.
He's obsessed, Heather said. Started off with this, must be, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. Added a podcast a couple of years back, when that other true crime one got really big. That American one. I think he's convinced he's headed for the big time too, but as far as I can tell, it's only a handful of people listening.
Another eye roll.
That was before the new girls, though.
I peered at the screen. Daniel blogs about crime? Heather frowned.
Don't you ever Google yourself?
Daniel doesn't blog about crime. He blogs about one crime. He's the internet's foremost nutter when it comes to the Canal Killer case. I tried to get this information straight in my head. Daniel O'Dowd was the man captured on CCTV and the man in my photo from back then. He was probably the man who'd been sitting outside my hotel, on the bank of the canal too. And his main occupation was blogging about all things to do with the canal killer. I was tempted to pause and text Malone his name right now, but Heather seemed all over the place, and I didn't know how she'd react.
He has credibility because,
Heather put on a dramatic movie trailer voice. He was there.
In first year, although it was his second year on campus because he changed course. And in the beginning, yeah, okay, it wasn't that weird. We were all obsessed with it in our own ways. I mean, any student who was here at the time is lying if they say they didn't trot out that fact whenever the subject came up. I bet hundreds of graduates are still feeding off the anecdotes at cocktail parties, first dates, whatever. I thought of Stephen, Sal's newest expat find, leaving a dramatic pause during introductions back at the Patrick's Day dinner party. Then I thought, God, had that just been 4 days ago? It seemed like another lifetime now, felt like another planet. But Daniel was different, Heather said. He was serious. He got stuff from the investigation, photos, reports, that kind of thing. God knows how. And then he declared he was going to prove what really happened, whatever that meant, and started badgering me to sit down for an interview about the night I was attacked. She sighed. Look, I like the guy. He's an innocent, and he had some trouble a few years ago. All this blog and investigation stuff, it helped him get back on track, gave him focus, and was harmless when it was all back in the past. But since these new girls started showing up in the canal, he's wandered right off the reservation, especially these last few days, especially when he found out you were in town. He'll freak when he finds out you're in my office. My mind was racing, desperately trying to sift through all this, looking for the pieces that, when fit together, would make some kind of sense. So you're friends with him? I asked. Duty bound, Heather sighed. I'm married to his sister.
Oh.
Yeah, guess you didn't remember that either.
Heather, look, it's not just you. I really don't remember a lot from back then. I try not.
I feel sorry for him, she said, cutting me off.
She turned to look out the window now.
He had a thing for Liz, a secret thing. So when she died, he was grieving too, but he couldn't show it. He was afraid people would think he was just trying to elbow his way to the front of the mourner's queue after the fact. And they would have thought that because people are assholes, aren't they? I was furiously flipping through my memories of back then, looking for something, anything of Daniel. I couldn't remember the night that the photo had been taken. But what was that thing that had happened at the traffic light ball? The weird guy she'd said had been bothering her. Could that have been Daniel?
Do you know if he tried to contact me? I asked. These last few days.
He did say he was going to try to call you at your hotel.
I think maybe he did. I had a hang-up.
Heather shrugged. Maybe he chickened out.
How did he know where I was staying?
Wasn't it in the papers?
Maybe.
Only after Daniel had paid me a visit, so he must have found out by other means.
I think maybe he broke into my room, too.
Heather blinked rapidly, theatrically. No, he didn't. He wouldn't do something like that. He's a crazy, yeah, but not breaking the law crazy, which is what I told the Gardaí. I decided to switch gears.
Did you know Daniel back then, back in college?
Heather nodded. We were in the debating society together. He's how I met Deirdre.
So there's no possibility that Daniel could be one of the men who attacked you. You would have recognized him, right?
Yet another eye roll. Oh, come on.
I'm just trying to figure this all out, Heather.
How nice for you. But keep Daniel out of it. He's done nothing wrong. She turned her computer monitor back to face her. Then she looked back to me. Wait, one of?
What?
You said one of the men that attacked me. There was only one.
I just meant, like, one of the men there. The attacker or the guy who came and helped afterwards, but then ran off.
Heather looked at me for a long moment, then she said, neither of them was Daniel.
Was either of them Will?
She shook her head, no.
You're sure?
I knew Will. Well, to see, I would have recognized him.
I let a beat pass. Detective Shaw, I said. You might have spoken to him about this. He has a theory about what happened to you that night. Well, two theories. The first is that it was like a practice run, that it was the canal killer, Will, Heather said, warming up. Wait, I thought you said it wasn't Will. I don't think Will was the man who attacked me that night, but I also don't think what happened to me had anything to do with the canal murders.
What makes you say that?
She turned up her palms. Because I'm not dead. I thought it was more because Heather didn't want to think that she'd only just escaped the clutches of a serial murderer by the skin of her teeth. But I didn't say this out loud. What's this detective's other theory?
That the guy who came to your aid, the one who ran off, was actually part of it. That he was the attacker's partner in crime, literally and figuratively. He swoops in, knight in shining armor, wins your trust. Then, well, you know. Why else would he have run off when those cyclists came?
Heather drummed her fingers on the table.
Is this conversation just between us?
I nodded, because saying yes without actually saying it felt like less of a lie.
Look, I knew the other guy, okay? Heather said. He was a friend. We'd been out together that night and he, being the complete idiot that he is, made a move on me. I didn't want it. He didn't want me not to want it. I decided to go home. He was following me. I mean, not like stalker following me. Just a friend following me, making sure I actually got back to Halls. So he sees someone cross the street to walk behind me. He sees something happen, sees me disappear from the path. He comes running. I'm in the damn reeds when he gets there, almost in the water.
When was this?
The Thursday night of Freshers' Week.
Within a college term, someone would have started murdering girls by attacking them on their walk home to campus and pushing them into the canal to drown. How could she possibly think her attack wasn't connected?
He starts shouting, she continued, kicking the guy who's, like, on top of me by now, and that guy runs off. Maybe 10 seconds later, the two cyclists rock up, and the first thing one of them says is, I've called the Gardaí. Well, that sent my friend bolting, because he hadn't just been drinking. Neither had I, as a matter of fact. When the Gardaí came, I didn't want to tell them about him, because I knew they'd go pick him up and find out that he was off his face, and he'd get in trouble just for trying to get me out of some. So I said I didn't know him either, or why he'd run off.
But you really didn't know the first guy, the attacker?
No.
Did you get a good look at him?
No.
But he wasn't Will or Daniel?
No.
How can you be...
He was taller, wider, and he just seemed, I don't know, older.
If Daniel was obsessed with the canal killer case, that would explain his frequenting the canal late at night. That would eliminate the CCTV images of him as being anything other than his bad luck. There was also, potentially, not quite an innocent explanation for me seeing him outside my hotel, but an explanation nonetheless. But who had attacked Heather? Was there a third suspect, someone totally unknown, someone never captured on CCTV, who was, in fact, the real canal killer? Someone who was able to go about his business while the Gardaí thought they had got their guy way back when, and were now searching the city for a guy doing research for his blog?
I never even saw the guy, Heather said. Neither did my friend, I checked. He came up behind me. I never saw his face.
She shifted in her seat.
I have an appointment now. I think she's waiting outside.
Right, sorry. I stood up. Just one other thing, Heather. All the victims back then, and you, were on the wait list for a room in Halls. Can you think of anyone you might have met on campus or some place you would have gone, something you did, that first years who weren't on the wait list didn't need to do?
Well, yeah. I went looking for somewhere to live.
Searching for alternative accommodation. It was so obvious, now that I thought about it. Students who were assured of their room at Halls all along wouldn't have to bother. Those who may or may not get a room needed a plan B.
This girl I knew from home, Heather went on. She and I were going to be roommates if Halls didn't work out. And honestly, we really thought we were going to be like Monica and Rachel until we actually started going to see the kind of places we could afford. Jesus, they were grim.
She shook her head at the memory. There was this one house, I'll never forget it, Harold's Cross. Student shit tips are us. The garden was all overgrown, the front door was rotting. All the doors inside were just like, what's that really cheap, flimsy stuff? Chipboard, MDF. Anyway, not door material. And the dirt, I'd never seen anything like it. The room itself was like a cupboard with a toilet in it. You could actually flush the toilet from the bed. But the worst bit was that when we were leaving, this guy who was living downstairs came out of his room, and not only was he in his underwear in the middle of the day, and in it in the hall, but he also had what looked like a serious case of pink eye, which, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you get from scratching your arse and then poking your eye. Heather made a face. It was truly disgusting. And miles from campus anyway. And get this, too expensive for us. She laughed. We were haunted until we got into halls. Yeah, I said absently. Listen, how did you go about that? Did you go to an agency or something? No, Heather said. We just looked places up online. How many did you go see? 6, maybe. 7. It was a bit too random to be the connection. 5 girls on the wait list, each one searching for properties on the internet, each one ending up going to different ones. But this would have been near St. John's, only days before college began, and in Dublin City during the height of the boom. Heather, I said, can I take your phone number? Alison, then. Christmas break was going to be a month long. As much as I loved Christmas, it was just one day. 2 if you included Christmas Eve. That left nearly 4 weeks of being stuck at home, with Liz and without Will. He was going away to some ski resort in the French Alps for a fortnight. He left at lunchtime on the last day of term. Liz and I were taking the train down to Cork together the following morning, so I had a night on campus without him. Claire had already left, so I had the whole apartment to myself. I was looking forward to hunkering down for the evening, with a movie or a good book, drinking endless cups of tea, and just basking in a night of alone time. If I couldn't spend the evening with Will, it was the next best thing. But Liz wanted to do something. I know, she said, sitting across from me in the student cafeteria. We should have a Christmas night. Go look at the Christmas shop in Brown Thomas. Get some hot chocolate at a fancy hotel. The Westbury, maybe. Or the Shelburne. I bet their decorations are amazing. That's what we should do. Have ourselves a little Dublin Christmas before we go down to Cork. Liz's eyes were bright with excitement, and I couldn't help but think that, actually, that would be a nice thing to do. I'd never been in Dublin at Christmas time, and the last couple of weeks had been the shock of exams suddenly looming over us, and then a mad scramble to shove enough information into our heads to fill the answer booklet before they got here. I hadn't really had a chance to walk around the shops. I was only ever off campus at night, and then huddled in a corner with Will in a pub, or out at a club with everybody, drinking. I was guessing the fact that Will couldn't join us was also contributing to Liz's enthusiasm. She wouldn't run the risk of being a third wheel. I felt bad that a night with just the two of us was now a rare occasion. I actually couldn't remember the last time we'd had one that didn't involve studying or pulling an essay writing all-nighter. So I said, yes, let's do it. Liz knocked on my door at 7 that evening wearing a Santa hat. I laughed. What the? No need to be jealous, Ally, she said, producing a second one from behind her back. Because I brought one for you too. It started off as a really nice evening. Grafton Street was strung with twinkling lights, and the buskers there had switched to Christmas playlists. Brown Thomas's famous windows had displays of seasonal party finery, arranged in wintry scenes. I'd heard grumblings on the radio that this year's window scheme wasn't kid-friendly, and that next year they should at least try to include a few toys. Every single shop we went into was copiously decorated, with Christmas music playing. There was only a week to go until the big day, and plenty of shoppers were taking advantage of the extended opening hours this Friday night. I bought a few small presents for my parents, a book for my mother, some whiskey for Dad, chocolates in the shape of reindeer for both of them, and Liz and I got mulled wine and mince pies from a food truck parked up under the intricate curl of a Georgian street lamp on Stephen's Green. We sat on the icy stone steps of one of the square's townhouses and admired the decorations hanging from other facades around us. They should put lights in the trees, Liz suggested, nodding at the black shadows beyond the wrought iron railing of Stephen's Green across the street. Hmm, I said through a mouthful of mince pie. The park closed at dusk every day, adding anything that only served its purpose in the dark would be pointless. I didn't say this aloud, though. Liz didn't like being contradicted. A horse-drawn carriage trotted past, carrying two people, tourists surely, huddled under a furry sheepskin blanket while taxis screeched past. They were followed a moment later by the pungent smell of what one of the horses was steadily depositing on the street as it sauntered past. Liz started coughing.
Oh my God.
Let's go. The smell was already at the back of my throat. Feeling warm and loose from the wine and slightly sick from the smell, we decided to skip the hot chocolate and start back towards St. John's. We just reached the canal when Liz said, apropos of nothing, did Will find that ski jacket he was looking for? What? I hadn't heard anything about any jacket. All I knew about Will and skiing was that he wasn't very good at it and loathed having to go do it for the next fortnight with his parents and siblings in tow. Yeah, Liz said. He was looking for it out in Dundrum. You mean in the shopping centre? When was this? Oh, she shrugged her shoulders. Thursday, maybe? I tried to keep my tone casual. You saw him out there? We had lunch. She looked at me. He didn't tell you? He hadn't, and that fact was all over my face. I could feel it. Liz was looking worried now. You know what? He had a little bag with him, like from a jeweler's or something. I bet he was out there buying your Christmas present. Maybe he didn't want to ruin the surprise. It made sense. I wanted it to make sense. So I smiled half-heartedly and said, and now he's busted. God, I'm so sorry. Pretend I didn't say anything, okay? Later that night, when I was back in my room alone, Will rang from France. I asked him how it was over there. He sighed. Cold and dark. I laughed. Sounds fabulous. I already want to kill them all. My brother's come up with this season of goodwill joke that he thinks is hilarious and original. He's wrong on both counts. Well, I said, season of goodwill. I miss you. I know it's not cool. It's only been like 6 hours. But I miss you too.